On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chee and Mr. Curtis Franklin. We talk about traditional conventional hard drives and how there's some new tech that uses lasers and microwaves to help pack as much as 60 terabytes into a drive. Pretty cool stuff. We'll talk about it. Plus, we have a great guest, Brendan Hannigan. He's CEO and co-founder of Sunry Security. And we're going to talk about the post-SolarWinds and identity sprawl. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on The Set.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 436, recorded March 26, 2021. Identity mode, random. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Barracuda. Hackers are always looking for the weakest link in your security configuration, especially in your email security. Barracuda's new threat analyzer tool helps you gain visibility into your particular vulnerabilities. Visit barracuda.com/enterprise. And by Forward Networks. Forward Networks reduces business risks by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model in software. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. And by Nareva. Getting your audio ready for meetings back in the office? Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. It automatically adapts to new room configurations so you're ready for the new normal and whatever comes next. Learn more at nareva.com/twit. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chee, net architect at Sky Fiber and one of the Sunshine State's newest residents. Chiebert, how are you doing, my friend, and what's keeping you busy this week?
Actually, sadly, this is a personal axe to grind. Spectrum gave away my home telephone number because they told me and swore up and down on a stack of Bibles, six different people on four different tech support calls, that they could move my home telephone number to the Sunshine State of Florida. And then I get a bill saying my service has been disconnected, and I call up and they say they gave away my home telephone number. So that is the last of soapbox on grinding on Spectrum. Darn.
So Spectrum's on the list. Comcast is on the list. We should just keep going on the list. I think nothing will be left after that.
Well, this is why I'm going to start up my own WISP.
Indeed. That's a good reason to do it. Well, thanks, Chiebert, for being here. Well, speaking of experts as well, we also have our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, how's the world of security treating you this week?
Well, security is treating me pretty well, but from a communication standpoint, I think we're going to be left with two oatmeal boxes and some kite string as an approved provider. It's an interesting time over there. It's actually a very interesting time as well in security. Lots of things going on. Of course, the bad folks keep us busy, and I'm starting to have conversations with some of the people in my group at Informa. You know, we're sister companies with Black Hat, so beginning the conversations about what Black Hat USA and perhaps even DEF CON might look like later on this year. And good news, it seems like both are talking about just the outside possibility that people might get together in the same space for at least part of it.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, we're looking forward to Black Hat this year. And speaking of looking forward to, I'm looking forward to today's show too, because it's pretty jam-packed with some information. This week has been pretty busy as well in the security space. We're going to talk a little bit of tech enterprise technology, though, and some hardware. Traditional spin disks are still the preferred data for data centers because of cost mostly, but there's some new technology out there that will actually actually increase the capacity of these spin disks safely and efficiently. We'll definitely talk about it. Plus, we have a great guest, Brendan Hannigan. He's the CEO and co-founder of Sunry Security. We're going to talk about the post-SolarWinds, if it's still post, I guess you could say, as well as identity sprawl. Good conversation there. But before we get to all of that goodness, we do have to go into this week's blips. Now, supply chain hacks are on the rise. This means that most open source projects are at heightened sensitivity to those potential vulnerabilities in their software. Now, OpenSSL is one of the most widely used software libraries for implementing a website and email encryption and has patched a high severity vulnerability that makes it easy for hackers to shut down vast numbers of servers completely. Now, OpenSSL provides time-tested cryptographic functions that implement the transport layer security protocol. Now, this is the successor to the secure sockets layer that encrypts data flowing between internet servers and end-user clients. People developing applications that use TLS rely on OpenSSL to save time and avoid programming errors that are in common when non-cryptographic users or developers build applications that use complex encryption. Now, the crucial role OpenSSL plays in the internet security came in full view in 2014 when hackers began exploiting a critical vulnerability in the library that let them steal encryption keys, customer information, and other sensitive data for servers all over the world. Heartbleed, as the security flaw was called, demonstrated how a couple of lines of faulty code can topple the security of banks, news sites, law firms, and a lot more. Now, OpenSSL maintainers disclosed this past week a patched and vulnerability that causes servers to crash when they receive a maliciously crafted request from an unauthenticated user. Now, CVE 2021-3449, as the denial of service vulnerability is tracked, results from a null pointer dereference bug. Now, hackers can exploit this vulnerability by sending a server maliciously formed renegotiation request during the initial handshake that establishes a secure connection between the end user and the server. Now, OpenSSL 1.02 is not impacted by this issue, but also there are some versions, OpenSSL versions 1.11H and newer, are vulnerable. So that means that what you need to do is that you need to ensure that you upgrade yourself to 1.1K as soon as possible.
Well, there's plenty of steel, rubber, iron, and aluminum, but automakers are cutting production because of a shortage of chips. Automakers have been expanding and extending production cuts at some North American plants as they cope with a worsening global shortage of semiconductors. Chips for use in cars and trucks have been harder to come by as semiconductor makers have allocated more capacity to consumer products. You see, the pandemic has caused a surge in orders for smartphones, TVs, and computers as people try to make extended life at home more bearable, leaving less capacity for a stronger-than-expected rebound in vehicle demand. Recent weather-related disruptions of petrochemical supplies in the southern U.S. and a fire at a chip-making plant in Japan have made the problems worse. In the latest news, Ford said it will temporarily shut down its Dearborn, Michigan truck factory starting today due to the chip shortage. The automaker plans to restart the plant on March 29th. The facility employs about 4,400 workers and makes Ford's best-selling and highly profitable F-150 pickup, so this is a big deal for the automaker. Nissan, Toyota, GM, and Stellantis have all reported factory shutdowns ranging from days to weeks due to the inability to get the chips that sit at the heart of all modern transportation.
Speaking of trucks and rust and all that, well, actually not. This is actually a Linus Torvalds story. So Linux is the poster child for the C programming language, but times are a-changing. We now have the Rust language and has been slowly gathering support for use as a system language for Linux. For example, at the 2020 Linux Plumbers Conference, developers gave serious thought to using the Rust language for new Linux inline code. So where is it today? The author of this article at ZDNet asked Linux's creator, Linus Torvalds, and the Linux stable kernel maintainer, Greg Kroll Hartman, for their thoughts. Why do any of this in the first place? Rust is popular because it lends itself more easily to writing secure code. Samartha Chandrasekhar, an AWS product manager, said, quote, it helps ensure thread safety and prevent memory-related errors such as buffer overflows that can lead to security vulnerabilities, unquote. Many other developers agree. In Linux circles, Alex Gaynor and Jeffrey Thomas at the 2019 Linux Security Summit said that about two-thirds of Linux kernel vulnerabilities come from memory safety issues. Rust, in theory, can completely avoid these by using Rust's inherently safer application programming interfaces. You know, I grew up in the days of a computer scientist having to know perhaps a dozen or more computer languages, depending on the task. What this is telling me is that the language developers are trying very hard to fix the issues learned the hard way. And it's time for dinosaurs like me to update themselves with new programming language that represents a step forward in security.
Now, Facebook continues to be a target for regulators and researchers alike. It means that Facebook actually has to beef up some of its security teams to encounter a lot more activity over the previous months. Now, Facebook has disrupted a hacking operation just recently. They used the social media platform to spread iOS and Android malware spied on people from China. Now, malware from both mobile OSs had advanced capabilities that could steal just about anything stored on an infected device. In fact, the hackers, which researchers have linked to groups working on behalf of the Chinese government, planted the malware on websites frequent by activists, journalists, and dissidents who originally came from China and had later moved abroad. The hackers seeded websites and malicious JavaScript that could stealthily infect targeted iPhones with a fully featured malware that Google and security firm Vlexity profiled in August 2019, last April. Now, the hackers exploited a host of iOS vulnerabilities to install malware, which Vlexity called Insomnia. The researchers referred to the hacking group as Earth MPUSA, Evil Eye, or Poison Carp. Some cool names there. Now, Insomnia had capabilities to exfiltrate data from a host of iOS apps, including Contacts, GPS, and iMessage, and third-party offerings from Signal, WhatsApp, Telegram, and Gmail and Hangouts. Now, to conceal the hacking and prevent Insomnia from being discovered, the exploits were delivered only to people who passed certain checks, including IP addresses, OSs, browser, and country and language settings. Now, Vlexity provided the following diagram to actually illustrate what that was actually happening. So if you scroll down there, you can actually see. It's a pretty cool diagram. Now, unless you have a connection to the China protesters, it's unlikely that you've been targeted by the operations identified by Facebook and other operations. In fact, Facebook's post provides indicators of the compromise for people who to check actually the signs of their devices and whether it's been hacked or not. Now, remember, the exploits worked against iPhones running iOS versions 10.x, 11.x, 12.0, and 12.1. Now, Vlexity later found exploits that worked against versions 12.3, 3.1, and 3.2. Now, if you're anxious, just ensure you're updated to the latest iOS release, and you should be a little better.
Well, this week, a new report says that nearly half of all popular Android apps are built with high-risk components. The analysis, published this week by Synopsys, looked at 3,335 mobile applications and showed that almost all of the most popular Android applications use open-source components. That's not a problem. Well, what is a problem is that many of those components are outdated and have at least one high-risk vulnerability. The software security firm analyzed the most popular Android apps in 18 categories, including gaming, financial, and productivity apps, and found that 98% use open-source code with an average of 20 components per application. Now, nearly half of the applications contained an open source component with a high risk vulnerability, and almost three quarters of the known vulnerabilities were at least 2 years old. Now, Synopsys defined high risk as issues that have already been actively exploited or have a documented proof of concept exploit. Less than 5% of those high risk issues have no fix currently available, which means that the report is a warning for mobile application developers to follow secure coding practices, track the open source components they use in development, and update their code regularly.
Months after the headline making SolarWinds a hack that impacted several government agencies and Fortune 500 companies, the White House is prepping an executive order to require software vendors to notify federal government customers if they experience a breach. Reuters is reporting the news after reviewing a draft of the order. If approved, it would impact major software companies that sell to the government, like Microsoft or Salesforce. A National Security Council spokeswoman said a decision on the order is still forthcoming, according to the Reuters story. News of an executive order on software security was first reported in February. At that time, White House officials said the order would encourage software developers to build more security into their products. The proposal on the table contains several recommendations, including the notification requirements for service providers. Vendors would still be required to preserve digital records for investigating hacks and work with the FBI and Homeland Security Department's Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, when responding to incidents. Congress has tried unsuccessfully in the past to pass a national data breach notification law. This concept shouldn't sound new to you. It is actually part of the GDPR in Europe and has been included in several attempts by other organizations to force disclosure of breaches. Perhaps it's time everybody gets a clue and fesses up so that we can mitigate damage and let the authorities gather evidence that hasn't gone stale.
Now, Firefox continues to be the trailblazer in privacy when it comes to browsing the web. Now, this week, Firefox 87 has announced Smart Block, a new intelligent tracker blocking mechanism for Firefox private browsing and strict mode. Now, Smart Block ensures that strong privacy protections in Firefox are accompanied by a great web browser experience. Now, since 2015, as part of the effort to provide a strong privacy option, Firefox has included the built-in content blocking feature that operates in private browsing windows and strict tracking protection mode. This feature automatically blocks third-party scripts, images, and other content from being loaded from cross-site tracking companies reported by or being loaded disconnectedly. Now, by blocking these tracking components, Firefox private browsing windows prevent them from watching you as you browse. Now, extra privacy modes introduce a policy that outright blocks the trackers on the web, inevitably risks blocking essential components from the websites to function correctly. So you actually don't get the normal experience with that browser now, with that site. Now, this can result in images not appearing, features not working, poor performance, or even the entire page not loading. Now, that's where Smart Block comes in. It intelligently fixes up a web page that are broken by other tracking protection without compromising user privacy. Now, Smart Block does this by providing local stand-ins for blocked third-party tracking scripts. Now, these stand-in scripts behave just like the original ones to make sure that the website works properly. They allow broken sites relying on the original scripts to load their functionality intact. The Mozilla Firefox teams promise that this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Smart Block innovations for Firefox. If nothing else, these new changes might be compelling enough for you to move back to Firefox. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Barracuda. Now, hackers are always looking for the weakest link in your security configuration, especially in your email security. Now, if you can find your vulnerabilities first, you can defend against the cyber attacks, right? Well, that's where Barracuda's new threat analyzer tool comes in and saves the day. Now, from traditional malware to the latest spear phishing account takeovers and conversation hijacking, Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats. And the thing is, it takes just several different layers of security working together to protect you effectively against all 13 threat types. Now, if you're not fully protected, cyber crooks are going to figure out where your vulnerabilities are at, and it's really what that they spend all their time on doing. And when they find that gap in your security, they just need to choose the right threat type and customize it to get into your system. Now, it can end up costing you millions of dollars and your reputation in the market as well. Now, here's where it gets hard. With hundreds of highly targeted personalized threat variants emerging daily and many different kinds of on-premises and cloud-based email systems, it can be really challenging to identify your specific gaps or vulnerabilities. That's what the Barracuda Threat Analyzer is for. Now, it's incredibly simple. It's fast to use. And you can go to barracuda.com/enterprise right now and just answer a few multiple choice questions about your email security setup. It takes about 2 minutes. And the Barracuda Threat Analyzer provides a custom report telling you which threat types you're most vulnerable to. And you'll get a custom recommendations on how to strengthen your defenses against those attacks as well. It's free and it's super easy to use. So go check it out. The Barracuda's December spear phishing report found 12 8% of all spear phishing attacks are business email compromise, and that's up from 7% in 2019. So, you know, get moving. Now, that kind of growth shows how successful these attacks can actually be. Now, I actually found that, you know, these types of attacks usually target specific things. Like, for instance, I've actually seen personally emails targeting COVID or pandemic or even vaccines and where you can get them. And so these types of spear phishing attacks, you click on the links you're interested, it's going to take you to a site, it's going to stall threat, and you're going to be compromised. Now, according to the FBI's most recent internet crime report, business email compromise attacks led to over $3.5 billion in losses. That's a lot. The government of Puerto Rico actually lost $2.6 million in a single attack last year. And even Shark Tank's Barbara Corcoran fell for one of these attacks last year. Her employees actually fell for an impersonation attack and paid a fake invoice wiring almost $400,000. Now, they were lucky enough to realize what they had done in time to actually recover the money. But Manor Independent School District in Texas wasn't as lucky because they've made a fraudulent payment over a month, losing $2.3 million before the attack was discovered. Now, does your email security protect against those attacks? Well, try the Barracuda Threat Analyzer today for free and get a full report showing exactly what you need to do to secure your email. Go to Barracuda.com/enterprise to find out where your hidden threats are. Lie. That's the Barracuda Threat Analyzer at Barracuda.com/enterprise. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bytes. Now, do you still use the mechanical hard drive? I know I do. Now, flash storage has become so cheap and available that outside of backup systems and NAS, SSDs and flash memory now hold the data on most of our devices, right? Well, hard drive shipments actually peaked in 2015, and a few are sold every year. But in terms of terabytes sold, hard drives are more important than ever. That's right. Within web storage and backups, we're dumping more of our data into the cloud and adding AI and big data, and global server capacity is increasing faster than ever. So that's where hard drives are really playing a role. Now, you can increase the storage capacity of a hard drive in a few ways. You can add more disks, platters. You can add more tracks per platter to make the bit smaller. Now, each of these have their problems, though. For one, we're just out of space to add platters. An 18 terabyte drive may be cramming 9 platters into a standard hard drive enclosure. Now, adding more bits or tracks have their own problems, too. They make it either smaller or you also need to shrink the write head. Now, if the head's too much larger than the tracks or the bits, you're liable to accidentally overwrite neighboring bits when you're trying to write, like trying to use a giant marker to write on a really narrow line. It doesn't work. Now, you can shrink the write head, but this actually makes it harder to generate the magnetic field needed to write the data. Now, you can cope with this by changing the platter material or by lowering its coercivity or how resistance is to outside magnetic fields. But this resistance is a problem. It's a big problem. Now, at the scale of nanoparticles like those on a hard drive, materials with low coercivity have a tendency to randomly flip their magnetic polarity. Not good if you really want reliability and long-term data storage. Now, the solution may be to have two techniques called microwave and heat-assisted magnetic recording, or MAMR or HAMR. Now, these actually use an energy source, either a microwave-generating device called a spin torque oscillator or a laser, to actually change the materials or platter's material. Now, this coupled with a more stable platter material and a smaller write head lets you pack more data onto each platter. Pretty cool. Now, Toshiba actually just shipped the first MAMR drive at 18 terabyte mile. Huge. Now, earlier this month, and the MAMR drives from Western Digital are expected shortly. And in fact, Seagate has a 20 terabyte drive that they're targeting enterprise partners. And in fact, we may actually get consumer versions out pretty soon as well. I'm going to bring my co-host in because, Cheapert, I want to start with you because obviously we always thought that, you know, traditional spin disks were on the outs because SSD was getting shorter. These types of disks are getting, they're getting less, they're getting cheaper, they're getting shorter to use, easier to use, easier to obtain. What is happening here? Like, why are they still focusing on the older technology?
Well, the older technology is, you know, tried and true, and it's been around for a long time. Now, the cool thing about what they're doing is it's actually not really super new. It's only new as being applied to spinning disks. The whole idea of using a laser and then a magnetic device of some sort to flip a bit has been used in certain types of optical storage. But now that the technology has gotten better, we're able to go and do a little bit more things. We're able to get a lot more data packed in a smaller amount of space. So they're taking a page from the optical disc folks. In fact, the last time I saw this was actually from Wang Industries. So that's a page from the history books. And we're able to pack an awful lot of data in there. So maybe, just maybe, this might be an interesting way for data centers to go and pack a lot more data on premise. And obviously, it's going to be good for the folks that are doing things in the data center world.
Right, right, right. Yeah, Curtis, I want to throw this to you, because obviously from an enterprise perspective, a lot of organizations are still looking for ways to squeeze more storage and more performance out of these, you know, more traditional disks, and of course, you know, lowering the costs and being more cost effective. Do you think that this will help? Do you think this means that enterprise storage and data storage will, you know, start still continue using these traditional disks as we move forward, and it'll cause the SSDs to maybe find new ways, and some of these other memory-based storage to find new ways to actually reduce the cost to make it more prevalent?
Well, I think what we will probably see is a lot of people trying to use both technologies. Something that we've seen over the last 10 years is that we have had a number of supply disruptions. First, there was flooding in Thailand that disrupted the spinning magnetic disk market. Now we're having a disruption in the semiconductor market. So I think what we're probably going to see is companies looking at both of these, playing the economics and looking at ways to have both of these technologies there to buffer themselves and protect themselves against supply chain disruptions. There's certainly room for both technologies in the enterprise data center. I'm just glad to see some genuine potential for improvement in spinning magnetic media.
Right, I agree. I think this is an interesting story. And Chibert, one more last question to you. They're talking about actually bringing this to consumers. Why would they try to bring this technology to consumers? I thought consumers were sold on moving to SSD. Even in the larger drives, I see a lot more people saying, hey, you know, I'm buying this, you know, 10 terabyte SSD. You know, I'm spending $300-$400, but I'm okay with doing that because of just the fact that of just the performance I'm getting out of it and a little bit better reliability. Do consumers really need this?
Actually, I'm not sure. The numbers that I've been seeing, you know, watching different podcasts and reading various articles, seems to indicate that the SSDs are still ruling the world for gamers. But for normal people that are just trying to store more stuff, you know, I'm starting to hear people doing bigger and bigger hard drives. So maybe, you know, this might be something that we're going to see in the consumer, but a little later. I think the 60 terabytes are going to be enterprise for quite a while. But it should drag up the smaller drives as, you know, as far as price. So I would love to be able to go and put, you know, be able to have really inexpensive 10 terabyte drives in my home NAS or 20 terabyte drives. And, you know, who knows what we'll see. Maybe we'll have this nice trickle down effect for the consumer.
Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, the guests, where we get to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. Before we get to the guests, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Forward Networks. Now, your network is mission critical to your business, right? Well, Forward Networks will help you reduce network outages, improve your troubleshooting, and eliminate those errors. Now, they reduce business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. In fact, four Stanford PhD graduates developed Forward Networks 7 years ago when they developed empathy for network operators and sought to actually apply principles of modern software development to the network. Now, their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network. It's pretty cool. And it's a completely accurate mathematical model and software and serves as a single source of truth for the network. Now, users can verify that their network is configured correctly, that it's compliant with policies, and it's behaving exactly as they intended. They can actually accurately predict the impact of proposed changes across every possible traffic path, so network operators can roll out those changes with confidence. Now, this ensures that your network stays healthy and agile at all times. Now, here's some of what Forward Networks can actually help with and actually does. Now, their dashboard provides key network insights with visualizations that are easily consumable and exportable. It's really easy to view them and actually use them. Now, automatically create an always accurate network diagram with full details about the topology of your environment. Now, search network behavior, configuration, and state network-wide with an intuitive and powerful tool. Perform end-to-end path analysis across your network from both on-prem and cloud infrastructure. And you can proactively identify potential connectivity and security policy violations as well. Now, in fact, you can verify that your network is configured and behaving exactly as it intended to be across on-prem, cloud, virtual overlay networks, and you can set, check, and customize policies for your entire network. Now, behavior disks are really cool, too. They allow a side-by-side comparison in one quick view of configuration file changes for any device between any points in time. Now, you can get 50% faster resolution of network trouble tickets, 90% faster fixes related audit processes, and 33% reduction in aborted network updates due to identified errors. Imagine searching for your network for what's causing the problems. Forward Networks allows you to do that and find them easily. Now, PayPal has been having issues with their network and considered building a better system. Instead, they turned to Forward Networks and found that all they needed was software that could find the trouble spots, saving them time and money. Now, Forward Networks collaborates with a range of infrastructure and application technology partners, from the world's leading IT companies to innovators. They work with Bank of America, Verizon, Goldman Sachs, and several large government agencies as well. Now, Forward Networks announced their Series C funding round last October, led by Goldman Sachs. Also participating were Andreessen Horowitz and Threshold, formerly DFJ. In total, their investors have committed $65 million. Get network automation and verification for your intent-based network with Forward Networks. Your business depends on it. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. That's forwardnetworks.com/twit. And check out their new podcast, Seeking Truth in Networking. You can download it wherever you get your podcast. And we thank Forward Networks for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Brendan Hannigan. He's the CEO and co-founder of Sunreese Security. Welcome to the show, Brendan.
Hey, very nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Duke.
Yeah, we're excited for you to be here. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and what brought you to Sunreese?
Yeah, well, firstly, in terms of technology, I started out back in Ireland working in Digital Equipment Corporation. I graduated with computer science, which was actually somewhat accidental. I went into college to study science in Dublin, and they made me take a class in Fortran in my very first year, and that converted me to computer science. I quickly majored in computer science. I realized I didn't need to do labs. And then my first job was actually, Brian was talking about WAC. It was in a company called Digital Equipment Corporation, writing software for terminal servers. And our big innovation was moving from 9600 baud to 19.2 baud. Then I actually came to the United States. I worked in a variety of switch and router companies, again, writing pretty sophisticated software for routing and switch networks. Companies at the time, like Wellfleet Communications and Digital Equipment Corporation, again. Then I took a time and I was working as an analyst, and I ran the network and security practice of Forrester. I ended up in 2003 joining a company called Q1 Labs. It was in the security intelligence and analytics space. It's actually, we grew that to be a very successful business. I met my partner and co-founder of this business called Sandy Bird at that company. He was a founder of that company. I ended up running everything from engineering, marketing, COO, became the CEO eventually, became a very successful business, Lou. We grew to be large. It was acquired by IBM. It is the base of the Q-Radar platform, which many of your listeners may know. And then for a few years, I ran IBM Security, actually, which became a big business. I left, and myself and Sandy started this business just at the end of 2017, focused primarily on cloud. I was also chairman of another company called Twistlock in the container security space. And so a full loop from terminal servers to cloud.
Right. Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I do want to hear a little bit about what kind of caused you to develop Sunreese, because I know that there's a good story behind that. And I'm very interested in just what kind of drove you guys to develop Sunreese.
it's something that I'm sure many people, you and everybody listening, would appreciate. That I started out as a software engineer and a technical person, and we built, if I look back in the last company, you know, we spent a long time building Q1 Labs. The reality is how we build software, how we build technology value has changed dramatically from not that long ago. We've gone from monolithic software to microservices. We've gone from 18-month development cycles to 2-week sprints and delivery. From centralized IT to innovation being driven by DevOps teams and business units. And also, you know, the reality that people configuring firewalls and us calling up IT to configure a VM to deploy our application is being replaced by infrastructure as code, where I can represent my code and my infrastructure I need, and it materializes in the cloud and comes away based on a Terraform or a CloudFormation template. And then finally, of course, it's all in the cloud. So this is what digital disruption is about. It's just basically the massive ways in which we can rapidly develop software in this new way. And the realization of our business was, if we're going to reinvent how it is we build technology, we must reinvent how it is we secure that technology in the cloud. It has to be done differently. It can't be reliant upon perimeters. And that is our mission, is to reinvent how we deliver security and manage risk, especially leveraging the capabilities of public cloud. And it's focused on a new set of foundational principles. And two of the most important are identities and data.
Right. So I think the interesting thing here is, obviously, we get very deep in identity. We talk a lot about identity, identity providers, different authentication schemes for those identities. What is changing? What, you know, obviously, we heard a lot about some recent attacks that have happened because of either, you know, people taking over identities, people not being able to check persistence as well as whether they're active or available and be able to take over identities. What's kind of changing there to help this?
Well, there's some things which are changing to help, and there's some things which have already changed to make it more complex, which means we need to rethink differently. And so, Lou, the area I would say is we spend a lot of time, with good reason, worried about what I call people identities, like me and you and what you and I can do. But in the new world, it's actually just scratching the surface. So take, for example, in cloud. We have many deployments which large customers, big financial institutions, big Fortune 100 companies, they may have hundreds of Amazon accounts, hundreds of Azure subscriptions and Google projects. And in there may be tens of thousands of roles and 80 to 100,000 different pieces of compute, a serverless function, a container, an ECS instance. They all have identities. We call them non-people identities. So one of the things that have changed, Lou, is that it's not just about what Brendan or Lou can do and what application I can log into. Think about opening up inside those public cloud environments and saying, what can that piece of compute do? And how is that changing over time? The scale of it is enormous. The power is enormous, but we have to rethink it. And essentially, that's one of the things we focus on. How do we automate and help our customers get their technology risk removed from that kind of complexity?
Right. Now, how does presence play a role here? Because a lot of times, obviously, identity is one thing. You can identify yourself. But then also, there's kind of a second factor that comes to that, which is presence. How does that kind of play into this role as well?
And presence as in, you're thinking really of, you know, people and the role of people and where they are.
Right.
Essentially. Yeah. You know what, right. Actually, it's absolutely, you know, in all instance, all activity, you know, presence and where we are, where we're coming from, what activity we're initiating, what I would say is for people and non-people identities is absolutely foundational. It's the context. It's, we have to know not just the identity, how it's authenticated, where it is,
right,
what it's doing. That is the essence of understanding, is there something unusual happening that I need to take action on? It's that combination. Right. Authentication is not, you know, it's beyond authentication. It's the context in which it's operating in. And that's basically what is possible actually in cloud, because you can run incredible analytics to have an incredible understanding of all the different ways entities can access resource in that environment and keep almost perfect track of it. It's just a lot of information, so you need a lot of analytics to go through it.
Now, that brings me to the next question. I think we've heard this term before in the industry about identity sprawl and having to handle all that. What does that mean? What are organizations having to handle there?
You know, there's many different places in which this is. If you think about it, there's just a sprawl of just technology in general. Of course, you know, it's just basically pervasive. Within a traditional enterprise, there's basically sprawl of IoT devices. There's sprawl over the number of ways I can rep myself as a person in identities. Then we actually go into the compute world. There's just enormous sprawl. We're not talking about, a company with, a couple of thousand employees and a large compute infrastructure may have 20 or 30,000 unique identities just in their cloud. It's not unusual to have 20,000 roles. Sometimes that's actually good practice, but that's what sprawl is. It's just incredible volumes of entities, people and non-people, which can get access to resources. And obviously in that context, it's not something where we can just track this the way we used to in traditional enterprise networks and data centers. We have to do it differently.
So a lot of organizations are moving to this multi-cloud infrastructure, both on-premise, the hybrid environments. How does that add to the complexity here as well?
So there's a couple of things which happen, and just to sort of do a double click on it, to give you one example, when you bring up kind of multi-cloud in particular, right? Is, you know, when you we're traditional kind of sense of security very often is focused on perimeters and building a perimeter firewall around a piece of infrastructure. And we all know how to do that. And we all have a lot of experience at that. When you get into the cloud, the nature of microservices applications allows for incredible interconnection between entities. And the most powerful kind of new critical control point isn't the firewall in the cloud. It's actually the identity and access systems, for example, inside Azure or inside Amazon. And we're not talking about, a handful of settings, as you would know. You're literally talking about thousands and thousands of ways I can grant rights and permissions to entities running in the cloud. Now, just imagine, this is a very difficult thing to understand in any one cloud provider. Most all companies we deal with have multiple cloud providers. And the nature of how they do that are incredibly different. So you're talking about complex and sophisticated identity and access and authorization models in the cloud of AWS, and another very different model for Azure, and another very different model in Google Cloud. That brings complexity. And as we all know, complexity brings risk because human beings, we know, make mistakes. And then there are holes left, and then there's breaches that are possible because of those holes.
So what should be organizations doing here then? I mean, obviously, they're going to have these types of environments. They're going to have the need for multiple identities that don't necessarily map to each other. And there, obviously, some of them do, but not all of them do. Does this mean that we have a third party kind of handle all of this, or does that create even more complexity for a system?
There's a big part of it is, so firstly, what I am really working hard with our clients on, we say, firstly, when it comes to security and risk, you need a new security operating model for these new environments. The way we did it in the past is not scalable. The types of information we need to act on and react to are different than the types of information going into a traditional security operations center. It's, for example, activity of a serverless function as opposed to, scanning, port scanning of an IP address that's hitting the perimeter firewall, just as an example. So that's one. We have to rethink it. And in that security operating model, there's new technologies to help you find risk, automatically remove that risk, and then ultimately get it to the right people for fixing it, which maybe in the past was the security team. In the future, it has to go right to developers. Today, it has to go right to developers. So, Lou, what do we do about that? So, firstly, companies have to realize that the models we had in the past are really different. Secondly, when we think of risk, you identity and the data and data sprawl actually are the key foundational cornerstones for your security strategy in this new world. And there's automated solutions. I mean, obviously, that's what my company is helping our clients and customers do. We have a system which will run analytics across a multi-cloud environment, and we build a graph. And it's very simple in concept. It's a graph which captures every which way any entity, a person, a serverless function, a container, can access any resource in that cloud. And then we run analytics across that graph, not just to tell people about risks and issues, but to tell them and actually give the code to remove the issue. That's how you automate it. You automate collection, automate analytics, and then automate the removal of the risk. It's wonderful, and it is possible. And it can be done in a multi-cloud way, too.
Right. Well, this is interesting stuff. I do want to bring my co-host back in a moment. But before we do that, I do have to go to another ad and thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Nareva. Now, as we think about heading back to the office, we know that the way we meet will actually change, right? Well, the distancing can actually have really big implications for meeting room audio, and it may actually require changes in room configurations as well. Now, the most important thing is the need for a good mic coverage, actually, when people are actually distanced in meeting spaces. But the most conventional audio systems do not offer the flexibility need to actually easily accommodate those changes. Now, beamforming systems will need to be adjusted, often by really expensive technicians that are out there. Now, tabletop systems may require additional mics as well. You may have to sanitize those mics between meetings every time. In fact, both may require meeting participants to actually change their behaviors, like sitting in predetermined spots and changing their direction to face a specific way. Now, what if there was a better way to get clear, reliable audio and let your team actually act naturally and still feel safe? Well, Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. Now, one analyst actually called Nareva Audio the first socially distanced mic system out there. And Nareva uses a completely original approach to audio conferencing called microphone mist technology. Now, I have to check this out. It's pretty amazing. It fills a room with thousands of virtual mics. You can get true full room coverage so people can be heard from anywhere in the room, no matter where you sit or face or how they're actually distanced. You don't need to bring in technicians with Nareva Audio because you can install each microphone and speaker on the wall yourself. And Nareva Audio automatically adapts to any room configuration. And in fact, microphone mist technology is so advanced, it actually has 4 patents. The Nareva Audio products have won numerous awards out there, including the Top New Technology Award at ISE 2020 for the Nareva HDL 200 system. No matter the size of your room, they have a full line of systems for small, medium, and large spaces. Now, HubSpot is a really happy customer. Jimmy Yan, the principal collaboration engineer, says, "We were so impressed with the sound quality, ease of install, and ease of use of HDL 300. It was a no-brainer for us to adopt it." To learn more about how Nareva Audio is the simple and cost-effective way to let your teams distance in meetings and still act and converse naturally, visit nareva.com/twit. That's nureva.com/twit. And we thank Nareva for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Brendan Hannigan. He's the CEO and co-founder of Sunry Security. We talked a lot about identity. And, you know, Cheebert handles a lot of security things. Cheebert, I want to bring you in first because, you know, what's going on here? What are we doing with identity?
Actually, I want to go set the Wayback Machine 10 years. And I remember doing a big comparative review for InfoWorld magazine on identity management. We actually had a scenario. We had a couple that met each other, got married. So we had a name change, got a promotion, got caught stealing from the company and was fired. And we wanted the system to track it through that. But it never went anywhere. I'm kind of wondering, I want to ask you in your crystal ball, was the concept of identity management a decade ago just way too soon? And is there any place for that concept today?
I think there is, Brian. There's no question that basically identities, given, especially if we think of the pandemic and the way people move around remotely, it's absolutely, it's critical, it's foundational. And to be able to keep track of it in a way that respects privacy, but actually also provides protection to business is absolutely critical. When something happens, we must be able to know what happened, who did it, when did they do it, how did they do it, what other things may they have done. And so it is very important. And I think actually from those 10 years ago, I actually ran a business when I was a part of and running the IBM security business. I ran some of the identity and access management business in IBM for a few years. And it has advanced that, you know, in general, identity management has advanced in traditional enterprises. I think where it's new is everything in cloud is new, and the way we do it in cloud is very new.
Fabulous. You know, there was some interesting things happening, and the hybrid world is just having a tough time wrapping your head around all the different things. One of the things that I dealt with a lot when I was working for the federal government is, how do you deal with when you have so many identities? And I got to imagine it's worse today. And what I want to do is I want you to ask you to put your crystal ball glasses on or whatever, and say, in a perfect world, if you could wave your magic wand and say, this is what we really need to go and deal with this identity sprawl, what would that product or technology look like?
So there's a principle, and the principle, Brian, is, you know, best described as zero trust, right? Which is, give entities the permissions and privilege that they only need to get their job done for the only amount of time that they need to get that job done. And that's true whether it is traditional enterprises or in public cloud, in what we will call the new infrastructure and digital transformation. Just because of the nature of traditional enterprises, it's harder to implement because of the complexities of legacy IT systems. But in the case of cloud, it's actually incredibly, it's possible. That is possible. The technologies are there. So we can literally discover all of the relationships which exist for every identity in the cloud. We can automatically build them into a graph and find risks. And then, Brian, give the code to the DevOps team to say, this is the code you need to get that to least privilege. So just think what just happened in that future. And what's possible today, obviously companies have to do it and believe in it and make it happen. What it means is, yes, there's tons of identities. There's tons of different ways in which compute is accessing resources, but we can actually lock it down and then monitor for unusual changes. I think we'll see all of that happen through incredible, efficient zero trust happen in cloud before we see it happen in a traditional hybrid world in our traditional enterprise network and data center, because of instrumentation, the machine intelligence we can apply, and the analytics, and actually the automated remediation. So I think that's what the future is. I think that's what's possible. We can make that happen.
You know, we've been talking about human identities, but I want to get back to the idea of process-to-process identity or service-to-service. You know, everything today seems to come back to SolarWinds, and that's a great example of a piece of software or service that had to have tremendous access into a network and the processes. With what you're doing, you know, are there ways to limit the kind of access that process identity has? And control that access while still allowing the software to do its job?
The answer is yes, Curtis, and you speak to something which is just a very real problem that under the covers sometimes is understood and sometimes not understood at all. And that is, so for example, it's not unusual in a modern infrastructure, let's say an Amazon or an Azure, to have 10,000 roles. 40,000 roles, 50,000 roles, those roles can be assumed by a process, essentially a machine identity, and that gives them access to a resource. Now, And human beings keeping track of all that, it's just not possible. Now the question is, can we, through analytics, figure out what that service actually really needs access to? There's a certain access it's given, and then there's a certain access which it actually needs. And we can view that by watching activity and then lock it down and say, this is what it is. So there's two things which happen when you do that. You illuminate to everybody, did you know that that service has access to 500 things, including two critical databases with sensitive data? Did you know that? And if you did, say that that's okay. And if it is okay, the second step we can do is to say, now let's monitor that if something changes. And this is not just a configuration change. Now it's basically a change in trust relationship because the process does something that's unusual, maybe from a different geography, maybe with a different app string, maybe in a different time. That is absolutely critical given the scale of what we call non-people identities or process identities. It is critical. There's without it, people are going to quickly lose control of what has happened. It's happening already. What's happening in these environments?
Well, there are a couple of concepts that get tossed around a lot when we're talking about identities and access. The two concepts are zero trust and least privilege. Now, they are obviously two very different things, but as you see it, should the two actually be used together to provide appropriate access for both people and processes when we're talking about critical data and infrastructure?
They should. And I add a third one, and it's for a subtle, important reason. So there's this, the concept of zero trust, the concept of least privilege, and there's another concept which is important. I call it least access. Because I may have lots of privileges which allow me to take actions in an environment, but I also may have access to a database, and that access may be represented with my identity. But actually, in a place like Amazon, that access actually can be allowed or prevented on the resource itself. This is the complexity we're dealing with, Curtis. And it's not just you can look at one thing to understand access. They're all interconnected. So I can do things like assume a role. I can actually take a right and pass it to a piece of compute, and as a result, increase the rights and privileges of that role. The only way to understand that is by graphing all these relationships to understand something called we call effective permissions. Why do we do that? It's to get to what you described there. The principle is simple. Here's your workload. What does it need to do? What is it actually doing through observation? Let's lock it down to that. Now, actually, let's make sure that that's what's expected and look for out-of-band behavior. It's actually, as we know, it's so hard to do that in a traditional enterprise network and data center. There's challenges, there's some kind of, you know, steps which require human beings. As it turns out, for the new types of workloads which we're developing and deploying in cloud, we can machine it all to the point of discovery, understanding all that access, and locking it down. So I think they all come together, Curtis. And I think the trick here is to make sure that we're truly going towards that goal. And companies that don't are really, really exposing themselves to substantial risk going forward on a scale that probably is very much underappreciated.
Right, right. Well, unfortunately, all good things have to come to an end. Brendan, thanks so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can learn more about Sunry, how they can get, you know, maybe even get started.
We really appreciate your time, Lou. SunrySecurity.com. We've got wonderful customers like World Fuel Service, Fortune 100 customers. We've got many large enterprises, but we do have starter packs for companies. We've got a wonderful, you know, fintech company out of the UK called Snoop, which started one of our starter packs. What we do is run analytics, find risks related to identity, related to platform configuration, related to data access, and remove them or get the actions to the developers that need to fix them. Very automated.
Yes. Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatchers to Twyatt for sure. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian G. Chiebert. What's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
Well, first things first, we've been talking Sonry Security, but we've never spelled it. It's spelled SONRAI security.com, but it's pronounced Sonry. Thank you very much to our guest. And, you know, we'd love to hear from our viewers. My Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB, or drop me an email at Chiebert, spelled CHEEBERT, at twit.tv. But, you know, better yet, why don't you use Twyatt at twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. We would love to hear from you. We'd love to hear show ideas. We've got pretty thick skin, so if you didn't think it was great, tell me. You know, I take criticism as well as anyone. So we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your ideas. We'd love to hear comments. You know, we actually even like snark. But anyway, you all take care and stay safe.
Thank you, Sheba. We do like snark. We do it. So we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I'm, of course, finishing up some reports for the folks who subscribe to our reports at Omdia, but I also have some things that are going to be out at Dark Reading. I'm working on those and considering even doing something regular and brief over on LinkedIn. So lots of interesting things going on. And as always, would love to hear from our listeners. You can, as Brian said, send email to the whole group at twyatt@twit.tv. Or you can send me a direct message on Facebook. On Twitter at KG4GWA. Follow me on Instagram or look for me over there on LinkedIn.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you to both of you for being here. Well, folks, we do have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. I want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to the show and catch up on your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, of course, the links of the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those really helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or on any one of your podcatcher applications as well, because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, but it's also the best way to actually support the show as well. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because we definitely talk about a bunch of fun topics here on the show, and I guarantee that they will find them interesting and fun as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available at these days on 1:30 Pacific Fridays, definitely check the show live, where we do it live at live.twit.tv. There, all the video streams are there for you to choose from. And we, you know, come see how the pizza's made. Come see the behind the scenes. Come see all the banter that we do during, before the show and after the show. It's live. It's great. And in fact, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well check out our chat room as well. It's a great live chat room at irc.twit.tv. We have some great characters in there. There's Ant showing the behind the scenes chat as well. We have some great topics that come from there. We have some great questions and some great discussions. So definitely check that out and be part of the discussion live. But you know what? If you can't be part of the show live, that's okay. And you still want to be part of the discussion, we have a great place to go for that. We have twit.community. It's a great website. It's 24/7 discussion. It's a great new community. It's discussion show content. The hosts are out there. The discussions on all types of technology and all the shows. So definitely go check that out and be part of the discussion 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post some of my enterprise tidbits. I also post a little bit of my gripes. But of course, I also have some great conversations with people like you as well. And you know what? If you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, I do post some stuff there as well. But you can always check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There, it's the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience to make it more productive for you and your organization. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, because we have a lot of people that help us here, and we couldn't do the show without them. Especially thank you to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support. Of course, thank you to all the engineers and staff at TWIT. I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time, just behind the scenes there. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the show bookings, the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Chibert, for all your support. Now, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Victor, of course. And of course, we have to thank our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, you are a very busy guy, and you also have some great content out there. What's coming up for you in the coming weeks here on TWIT?
Well, we're still doing some good old hands-on photography content. I had a lot of fun talking to my man, Mr. Photo Joseph, this week. And then also, there was an official announcement of a workshop that has been kicked off that I will be teaching at. So make sure you go and check that out. That is wanderersphoto.com. And go ahead and sign up.
Fantastic, fantastic. Definitely check that out. Thank you, Ant. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep TWIT.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, and I want to tell you about my show, Hands-On Photography, here on TWIT TV. Each and every week, Thursday, that is, I like to sit down and share with you the best tips and tricks that are going to help make you a better photographer. And it's not always about Photoshop. It's not always about just having the biggest and baddest and bestest camera. It can be the simplest of things, like leave your eye open when you're looking through the viewfinder. All of these simple tips can really help step your photography game up. So subscribe to the show today. That's twit.tv/hop. And I look forward to talking to you soon.